The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. So some of you who know me, heard me speak before, I find articles in our newspapers in our firewood stove starting stash that offer a good starting point for Dharma reflection. I'm very particular to the Chronicle. I was born and raised in San Francisco, and you know, that's where I'm familiar with the paper. Usually when I get these articles, they're old, 2-3 months, sometimes 2 years. It's okay, you know. As I say, they can sometimes be, at least for me, good starting points for Dharma reflection. Well, I was down in the Bay Area a couple weeks ago visiting my brother. He's in San Francisco. He gets the Chronicle. And he actually, it was Saturday morning, July 12th, 2014, he showed me this article, the Saturday paper, okay? And I think that this article is a weekly column by a woman called Kylie Milner. I don't think it's an everyday, I don't think she writes an everyday piece in that particular paper, but, okay. And the article is entitled, "It's Hard to Be Alone with Your Thoughts." Okay. Half of her article, it's just not a, you know, it's four columns. It's not real big, okay? But half of her article is about a study that was done recently at the University of Virginia. And then the other half of it is her reflecting on how she's not all that different than the people in the study. In a lot of ways, that's more what I'm interested in than the findings of the study, although they're, you know, at least interesting. Maybe not quite what you thought. But her honesty about her own tendency to constantly distract herself. She's very obviously a very intelligent person, good writer, but she's real honest. She distracts herself, and she kind of looks at the things she distracts herself with, but she doesn't blame the internet, modern technology, all this stuff. It's her choices, okay? And I found that really refreshing. I think very Buddhist in the sense that I think it is more valuable than to criticize something is to reflect upon it. Because sometimes when we really look, we're not so different than the people that we want to criticize. I mean, there's some bits of that in ourselves. And also, to have sympathy maybe is better than to criticize. So let me tell you a little bit about the study that she's talking about. Okay. So what happened, let me say this too, is what happened was she was sent articles on the study. And those who sent her articles basically said, look at these idiots. Aren't we glad that we're more enlightened than them? I don't really think that helps anybody. And she didn't, you know, she said initially that was her response after looking at the study. But then she started to look at herself and look around and, you know, what she was doing. And she, you know, as I say, was very honest about some of her difficulties. And what I would like to do is offer the study as a way of looking at ourselves rather than criticizing those who partook in the study. So let me tell you a bit about the study. Again, it was a very recent study. So I'm sure, you know, at least done in 2014, maybe, you know, just a few months ago. And it was led by a social psychologist at the University of Virginia named Timothy Wilson. You can look up the study on the internet. I mean, you can look up his name, the study, and there are pages of magazine and newspaper articles on the study. And depending on which one you read, and I stopped after about four or five because you know how it is on the internet, you can just go on and you know, depending on which study, which article you read, they have a little bit of different take on the study and they bring out certain points. So we have to take this all with a grain of salt. Okay, I didn't read the original study. I didn't find it right away and didn't choose to go hunting for it. Right. So the researchers performed 11 experiments with hundreds of undergraduate students at the University of Virginia and members of the wider college community. So it wasn't just college students, but it was members of the wider community. And they were all volunteers. I think maybe you get some money for doing these, too. So, but, you know, they weren't forced into the study. So those in the study were asked to sit undisturbed. This, as I understand it, means no cell phones, iPods, or even the old-fashioned pen and paper by your side. You're asked to just sit by yourself. This is interesting the way they put it, and entertain yourself with your own thoughts. And some of the periods of time were 6 minutes and some were 15 minutes. Okay. In some of the studies, they did 11 different studies with these hundreds of people and slightly varied things in the studies. But in some of the studies, some of the people were told to think about whatever they wanted to during that time. They could just sit there and think about whatever they wanted to. But basically, the idea was they weren't supposed to, you know, distract themselves with other things. They're just supposed to be with themselves. And then some of the other people in some of the other phases of the study were given topics that they could think about, like going to eat or going on vacation or playing a sport, basically doing something pleasurable. You know, they were given, they said, you can talk about this. Okay, so in the first six studies, which were done in that way, either people just sitting there by themselves, being with their mind, or people a little bit more directed in their mind. But in the first six phases of the study, 50% of the participants rated the experience as somewhat hard, not very enjoyable, and boring. And interestingly, in the first six studies, the individuals were placed in plain, sparsely furnished rooms. Don't see that as a problem. Okay, in the seventh study, they decided to do something a little bit different to see if the surroundings made a difference. So they said they allowed the participants in the seventh study to do it in their own homes. Well, it turns out that 32% of the people admitted to cheating when they did this in their own homes. I'm just presuming that's looking on their computer, their cell phones, picking up a book. I don't know, turning on the television, something. But they couldn't just be there for probably 6 to 15 minutes, depending. Okay. So then they started. the researchers decided to take the experiment a step further. For 15 minutes, the researchers left those in the study alone in a lab room in which they could push a button and shock themselves if they wanted to. It sounds ridiculous, but and they didn't think people would do it. And in fact, they gave the people a taste of the shock. It was a shock from a 9-volt battery. A 9-volt battery is what is in a smoke alarm. So it wasn't a big shock, it was just a tiny shock. But they knew what the shock would be like. Well, it turns out, this is a very interesting statistics, that 67% of the men and 25% of the women in the study chose to shock themselves on average 1.7 times during the 15 minutes. Rather than just sit there with their own minds. So they knew what the shock was going to be. They shocked themselves. It wasn't a big shock. The researchers didn't think anybody would do it. But they did it. There was one gentleman who did it 190 times. They discluded him from the study. Something was funny there. Okay. And then, very rightly. I learned about studies in college when I took sociology, and you got to throw some things out if they're really strange. So the person that was head of the study, Timothy Wilson, in a few of these articles that I read online about the study, they quote him, and he says, "We went into this thinking it wouldn't be that hard for people to entertain themselves. We have this huge brain, and it's stuffed full of pleasant memories, and we have the ability to construct fantasies and stories." We really thought that in the 66 to 15 minute period where people are just sitting there, that people would like it. That wouldn't be something difficult and boring. And as I say, he didn't think people would shock themselves. Okay, and then someone says that Timothy Wilson also suggests that the results of these studies may be mixed signs of boredom and the trouble we have controlling our thoughts. And Timothy Wilson goes on, "I think our mind is built to engage in the world. So when we don't give it anything to focus on, it is kind of hard to know what to do." Those are really different approaches to the mind than at least the way I was taught, in my religious practice. But I guess it's, what people, the whole idea of pleasant memories, which are fine, but we also know we have unpleasant memories. We have the ability to construct fantasies and stories. Well, it doesn't actually serve us all that well a lot of the time. So it's a different way of thinking. Okay. So Kaylee Milner in her Datebook article says, "Most of the results aren't news to anyone who has ever taken a meditation class." This woman is really honest. "Sitting by yourself alone with your thoughts can be difficult. As for the shocking oneself," she says, "this behavior is unexplained and unexplainable." Kind of agree with her there. So that's the study, some of the researchers' thoughts about it. And I don't really want to get into criticizing the people in the study. I don't know who these people were, I don't think I'm better than them. I don't think they're idiots. I sure as heck don't think I'm more enlightened than them. As I say, what I really appreciated was this woman who wrote the article in the newspaper about the study, Kaylee Milner, was her honesty here about her own tendency to distract herself. So we have been really fortunate to have come in contact in this lifetime to the Dharma. The teachings of the Buddha, the precepts, and if our particular type of meditation, there are different types of meditation in Buddhism, and I think they're all fine, but you pick one, usually. And I'm happy with the one that I picked. I think we're just fortunate. Not better, but fortunate. It's interesting, River Master G.U. Kennett used to say, can you do 5 minutes of meditation regularly? And we're not talking 6 to 15. She said 5 minutes regularly. And you know, it's a good question for all of us. I remember once telling River Master Hario, the head of our order, about preseason football. I was a football player. So before the season, you'd come to school 3 weeks ahead of time, really hot, where I played in college that time of the year, smoggy. And you'd have these two-a-day practices. Actually, my high school was even harder than my college. But anyway, these two-a-day practices. And it's really hard physically, you know, and challenging. And there's a mental component to that, too. So mostly physically, you're just exhausted, you know, and it's day after day after day. Where Master Hario's comment was, he said, could those same people make it through a meditation retreat here? And I thought about it and thought, geez, you know, he's right. They'd find that much harder. So, you know, some people, it wasn't a thing I was particularly taught growing up to be alone with my mind and to be able to just be with my mind. It's actually in reading Joan Baez's autobiography when I was a college student, and she talked about, can you sit on the hill, you know, it's a beautiful rolling green hill, for 5 minutes and not pick the weeds and, you know, make little things out of the grass and, you know, can you just sit there? And honestly, it was really hard for me, but I took that as a kind of a beginning place of learning how to meditate, just to be able to, you know, I didn't know that I was doing that, but in retrospect, I was learning just to be with myself. And of course, it was a really troubling time for me. So to be alone with your mind when you're troubled, that's really, really hard. I think what I've learned from years of meditation practice is, though, it's actually better, by and large, to be with your mind, whatever shape it is in, you know, if you're having a difficult time. I think I can say that I have found that the quicker way through it is to be with that. Not to hold on to it, you know, not to make it more than it is, not to, you know, make it this great matter of suffering, but just to be with it is really an important thing. Okay. But, you know, obviously a difficulty these people had we're having in the study of, you know, hundreds of people having a problem being with their own mind. And there wasn't necessarily anything wrong, and they were being paid to do, probably being paid minusculely to do what they did. You know, I think to do Buddhist practice, you have to take a good look at your mind. There's no way around that, because it's part of you. It's part of your makeup, so how could you not? I mean, you have to look at everything. That's the point. You know, the whole idea of the Buddha, the awakened one, was someone who was present to everything. So that's what we have to do. We have to be present. And if we're honest with ourselves when we're present, it's not always nice, not always pleasant. You know, it's a mixed bag. And how could it not be a mixed bag? And a mixed bag can be okay. Okay? River Master Jiyu told us the story of a Westerner in Japan when she was there. And I think it was in one of the big monasteries. It may have been in Soju-ji. But he was a lay practitioner. They were sitting there in meditation. He punched out the screen. He put his hand through it because he couldn't stand his mind anymore. you know, maybe that was a release for a bit of something, but I think he probably had to go back to his mind and continue to look at it. And you know, hopefully he found a better way to be with that. The Buddha said that the mind is hard to check. It's swift, it flits wherever it listeth. To control it is good. A controlled mind is conducive to happiness. He also said, the trained mind gives one the best, what neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do. A well-trained mind does. It elevates one. So again, we have to look at our mind. I would go so far as to say you have to be at peace with your mind. Because if you're in an argument with your mind, it's really difficult. You know, it's really painful. And of course, you know, body and mind being one, your body just, it starts to take it out on your body. Okay. Yeah. And I don't think that as Buddhists, as people who possibly meditate, that we're better than other people. I just think it's a better place to be. I've seen the other options for myself. I think it's a better place to be. And of course, the whole thing about Buddhist practice is you have to do it. It's not like you get a piece of paper and read something and then you got it, and that's, you got to do the practice. Okay? I was talking to somebody yesterday and they were saying meditation is very hard to do. And actually I said, it's not that hard. It's not that hard. And when people say they can't meditate, I don't understand that. You know, and they say they're not good meditators. I mean, that's just a self-judgment. If somebody says they're a great meditator, then I'm a little worried, you know, maybe. So, I mean, you don't want to have false humility, but the ability to meditate, I mean, if you can breathe, you can meditate. And you just do it, and you keep at it. And yes, it takes discipline, and it takes doing, you know, and practice. Oh, it's interesting, in some parts of the study, the researchers somehow they found out who were the more agreeable and cooperative people. Maybe they just asked the people, do you tend to be more agreeable and cooperative in life? But anyway, those people were more likely to enjoy the just sitting there with themselves. I found that very interesting. Because if you have an argument with yourself, if you're not agreeable with yourself and other people, the mind is it's a hard place to be in. It's not very, very peaceful. Okay. So my experience with the meditation practice is that you put down the argument. You don't wipe out the mind, but you put down the argument. Okay. I mean, it's part of the process of not holding on, not pushing away, not grasping. You know, that's really letting go of the argument. And consequently, you learn to like yourself. Pretty good idea, you know, to like yourself, because we're what we got. But I mean, it's amazing how many people don't like themselves. And it's good to like yourself. And to know yourself. And then I think life has much less suffering. So our type of meditation in serene reflection meditation is not about daydreaming or blocking out thoughts in the mind so that, you know, when they're talking in the study about daydreaming, I mean, maybe that was the problem. Maybe if they'd explained to them about serene reflection meditation, it wouldn't have been such a deal. I don't know, maybe so. But, you know, I mean, for me, 5 minutes initially was very hard, extremely hard. So 15 minutes, you know, that would have been very hard. But, you know, it gets better. So it's our type of meditation is not about daydreaming, not about blocking out the thoughts. It's really about being present, not holding on, not pushing away, not adding anything, not taking anything away, seeing things just as they are, you know, which is really important in life. I know I catch myself often not seeing things as they are, but realizing at least that I didn't, oh, that's how it is. It wasn't quite how I thought it was. And, you know, I take this study as a reflection for myself to see where I'm distracting myself in my meditation and in my everyday life. I'm a bit of a radio freak. I don't know, maybe I'm distracting myself. I mean, I'm not going to get all worried about it, but, you know, something to look at. I like to do things, you know. You know, Master Jiyu Kennett said, just don't do something, sit there. And she tried really hard to help us young people who were with her to learn how to just sit there. And, you know, it was hard, but it was worth it. I learned a little bit about that. But I think it's good without being obsessive and overbearing to look at how we might distract ourselves. It doesn't help to beat the mind, you know, in our trying to get a hold of the mind. It doesn't help to beat it. There, I think, really has to be more discipline, compassion, and humor, because our minds are very funny. You know, some, the things we come up with are, you know, there are some really funny stories that come up in the mind, or ways of viewing things. And of course, the mind also comes out with things that are very accurate and helpful. And it's the discerning of that, which we learn to do through our practice, which is not only, you know, us alone, but sometimes we talk with other people to be able to help discern what is the best decision, what is it that we should do. Yeah, I don't think that the discipline of a trained mind has to be Spartan. I actually found, you know, I worked in the kitchen a very long time here. I found that I got too organized. And because I could just boom, boom, boom. And it was almost mechanical. You know, I could be 4 days ahead on the meals because I knew the vegetables, I knew what it took. But I found that there was something funny there. You know, it wasn't meditative. It was more just a kind of this aggressive organization. So I got disorganized a bit and pulled back. And I learned to let things teach me rather than me being the one who, you know, had the reins all the time. And just kind of flowing with things. Now, you can really make some big mistakes that way. Things can get away from you. So you got to be careful. But it's the middle way. Personally, I have books all over my room that I have partly read. I kind of remember where they are, but sometimes books, notes, I lose them, you know, and I find them. You know how it is with notes when you find them and you realize it's too late now? There's a certain relief, maybe, but there's also a certain, oh, I'm sorry, you know. Yeah, so if you miss something, you just have to say, I missed it. And some of that can be the consequence of, there's a lot of stuff, but it's also how we deal with the stuff. So it's good reflection for me. You know, you can be an A-type. Everything can be organized. You can have read every book through. You know, I just read one book, boom, I'm through. I get the next one, boom. But, you know, that's not necessarily it. You know, that can be a distraction in its own way. This meditation practice, this ability to live peacefully in your own mind, isn't about controlling everything. Okay? Just seeing it and seeing whether it's good or bad or in between, and what do I do? And, you know, sometimes the answer is I don't know. I just do something. And sometimes things get a little bit more than we can handle. Okay. So maybe we come back to where we can handle it and we find a better way to do it. But it's not like we're the perfect organized person who has all the answers. And of course, with the mind and meditation, it's taking that stillness out into our activity in our everyday life, which is the important thing. It's not about just sitting on a cushion or sitting in a room, you know, quietly. It's the ability to bring that out. So some people are are very good at sitting still. Some people are better at taking it out, taking it into activity. Okay. You know, you just have to balance them. But to say you can't do either, and you're not good at either, I just don't buy it. I'm sorry. Don't buy it. Because I can do it, you know, as best I can. And sometimes it's not very good, but I can do it. Okay. Anjan Cha used to say, have one chair in your mind and know who your visitors are. And I think that's a good idea, you know. The idea that you know who your visitors are. You need to know your mind. Take responsibility for your mind. And you can have a peaceful mind. Okay. It's interesting because Nagarjuna, from what I understand, extremely intelligent person, you know, great intellectual capacity, but he needed to do something more. And I think if I read the Denkuroko correctly, part of his problem was he couldn't see what was right there. You know, how we sometimes can be so caught up in here that we can't see the jewel that we have right in front of us. And I think that's the secret to life, is to see the jewel. I want to just end with something from the Platform Sutra by Venerable Huinang. Okay. Find it here. He says, the Buddhas of the three periods and the 12 divisions of the canon are fully present in this nature of yours. If you can't realize this by yourselves, you need to find a good friend to show you how to see your nature. But if you realize this by yourselves, you don't need to look for a good friend somewhere else. He's quite big on the good friend is right here. Okay. And if someone insists that you have to find a good friend somewhere else before you attain liberation, that place doesn't exist. So he's not saying that you can't find a good friend. It just says, look here first. You will attain liberation when you meet the good friend inside your own mind. So there's this good friend in that one seat in our own mind. But as long as your mind is full of confusion, delusion, and mistaken views, even the instructions of an external good friend won't be able to save you. If you can't realize this by yourself, the moment you give rise to the light of prajna, all your delusions will vanish in a flash. So he was with people. He, you don't have it, but you can have it, and it can be in a flash. You know, it's very, very positive. Okay, with one realization, you reach the stage of Buddhahood. Well, I think he meant you also have to keep going on. Yate gate paragate. Use this wisdom to illuminate the land of the mind of your nature. And when inside and outside are perfectly clear, you will know your own mind. Once you know your own mind, you will be free. And once you have gained your freedom, this is the samadhi of prajna. So one of our chants was about the mother of great wisdom, prajna paramita. And the realization of samadhi of prajna is no thought. Okay. And what do we mean by no thought? The teaching of no thought means to see all dharmas without being attached to any dharma, to reach everywhere without being attached anywhere, to keep your nature pure so that when the six thieves pass through the six gates, so our sense organs, the six thieves, the six gates, they neither avoid nor are corrupted by the six realms of sensation, but come and go freely. This is the samadhi of prajna. Freedom and liberation constitute the practice of no thought. And he was very clear that no thought didn't mean that you had an empty mind. He actually said this is a disease. It's the Zen disease. You know, trying to have an empty mind. Well, sometimes the mind is quiet. But a lot of times there's just all kinds of stuff You know, it's like a river going through there. But it's like a river, actually. It flows through. It doesn't have to get stuck. This is the Samadhi of Prajna. Freedom and liberation constitute the practice of no thought. But if you don't think any thoughts at all, the moment you make your thoughts stop, you're imprisoned by the dharmas. So he's not saying stop the thoughts in your mind. That is not being able to know your mind. We call this one-sided view. Those who understand the teaching of no thought penetrate the 10,000 teachings. Those who understand the teaching of no thought see the realm of Buddhas. Those who understand the direct teaching of no thought reach the stage of enlightenment. So that's about us all. That's all he's just talking about us. And, you never know. These people in this study, may be the next Buddha. We don't know. Half of them are probably just college students. And, as college students, you'd shock yourself, maybe. I probably would have, to be honest. So, thank you.